This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Both U.S. President Joe Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy are speaking hopefully of the likelihood of an agreement to raise the government's debt limit and avert an economically chaotic federal default. Yet House Republicans are pushing debt ceiling talks to the brink as they left town Thursday for a long Memorial Day recess. It's a display of risky political bravado. They're just days out from a potentially devastating debt default if Congress fails to act to raise the borrowing limit. Both the sides are still meeting, and President Biden said he and McCarthy have been speaking continuously as well. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is working to push past an embarrassing beginning to his presidential campaign. The Republican outlined an aggressive travel schedule Thursday and announced he had raised $8.2 million in the 24 hours since entering the race. His team insists they remain well-funded and well-positioned for a long fight ahead. Still, DeSantis faced nagging questions about his rocky rollout during a conservative media tour. The 44-year-old governor formally launched his campaign Wednesday during an online conversation with Twitter CEO Elon Musk, but the audio stream crashed repeatedly. DeSantis' allies privately acknowledged that the situation was an unwelcome distraction, and there is still broad sense that the announcement snafu will have limited long-term political consequences. Lawmakers in several states are looking to loosen child labor laws, even as the federal government cracks down on surging violations in at least 10 states. Legislators have proposed letting children work longer hours and in more hazardous occupations as a fix for labor shortages. This is VOA News. The European Union's top diplomat said in Havana on Thursday that the 27-member bloc remains Cuba's top trade partner despite U.S. sanctions on the communist-run island. We get details from VOA's Marissa Melton.
EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell, during his first public appearance on a four-day trip to Cuba, told a group of local entrepreneurs that the European Union was also the second largest source of tourists to Cuba behind Canada. Cuba says the U.S. sanctions have contributed to its recent drive to increase commercial and trade ties with Russia. Russia has also faced sanctions from both the United States and the European Union following its invasion of Ukraine last year. Cuba has said Russia is not responsible for the Ukraine conflict. It blames the United States instead. Marissa Melton, VOA News.
U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin says European allies are developing a coordinated program to train Ukrainian forces on the F-16 fighter jet, but Pentagon leaders warned that it will be a costly and complex task and won't be a magic solution to the war. Austin says that allies recognize that in addition to training, Ukraine will also need to be able to sustain and maintain the aircraft and have enough munitions. And he says that the air defense systems are still the weapons that Ukraine needs most in the broader effort to control airspace. The founder of the extremist group, the Proud Boys, Stuart Rhodes, was sentenced to 18 years in prison for seditious conspiracy in the Capitol riot. AP correspondent Ed Donahue with more.
Announcing the sentence, Federal District Judge Ahmed Mehta described Rhodes as a continued threat to the country and democracy. Edward Tarpley Jr. is Rhodes' attorney.
We don't think he's a threat to society. We don't think that at all. And, you know, absolutely he has a right to free speech.
18 years is the longest sentence handed down so far in a Capitol riot case. Tarpley says there's no way Rhodes was a leader of what happened at the Capitol.
He was just a convenient target. The Oath Keepers were a convenient target. The DOJ looked at them and said, oh, here are the scapegoats of what happened on January 6th.
Rhodes calls himself a political prisoner. Judge Mehta told Rhodes the moment he is released, whenever that may be, he will be ready to take up arms against his government. Ed Donahue, Washington.
More at VOAnews.com. Again, VOAnews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, May 26th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. African Union marks Africa Day with calls for international solidarity to realize the continent's potential.
Yes, sir. Et malgré les difficultés de tous ordres.
I know that despite the difficulties of all kinds, Africa remains characterized by its great capacity for resilience.
The United Nations asked Malawi to stop forceful relocation of refugees. Zimbabwe journalists aim to avoid violence in this year's elections. There were no violations on Thursday of Sudan's short-term ceasefire.
I can confirm here from Khartoum, where I'm living, many parts of this capital trigger a conflict since this morning.
And this morning, we remember the late Tina Turner, queen of rock and roll. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The African Union has called on its member states to build the Africa they want. Speaking yesterday, Thursday, during Africa Day celebrations in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, African Union Chairperson Moussa Faki Mahamat said that many member states face a crisis brought about by deadly internal conflicts and by the uncontrolled quest for supreme power. At the same time, the United Nations has urged the international community to stand with Africa at this time when the continent is facing historic and economic problems that hinder its progress. Maureen Ojiambo reports.
The African Union celebrated its 60th anniversary of the founding of the AU's predecessor, the Organization of the African Unity, on Africa Day. This as member states were called on to embrace peace and unity. AU Chairperson Moussa Faki said that significant progress has been made across the continent despite the external forces where the gains of others would translate into losses for Africa. He calls on African states to resist all forms of what he calls instrumentalization of African member states.
Yes, sir. Et malgré les difficultés de tous ordres.
I know that despite the difficulties of all kinds, Africa remains characterized by its great capacity for resilience. It was able, despite alarmist forecasts at the time, to hold firm in the face of onset of the COVID-19 pandemic. Better still, it seized the opportunity of this misfortune to rethink its health strategy in a concerted action by our heads of state and government. An evidence that if Africa wants, it can, whatever the nature and type of adversity it may have to face.
The AU says a conducive environment should be created to encourage and protect intellectual prosperity and to ensure privacy and security that enables Africa to participate fully in the global economy. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed says many countries across the continent lack the ability to sustain themselves.
We are free when our people are still in the grips of poverty and our systems are shocked by corruption, ineptness, and indifference. Can we yet assert independence while we seek beyond ourselves and our continental borders to deliver us from the challenges we are faced with?
According to the AU, peace, security, democracy, and development of the continent are threatened in many countries. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres says African countries are underrepresented in global governance institutions. He says the continent has also been affected by the denial of debt relief, loans, and funding.
Guided by the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development and the African Union's Agenda 2063, we must ramp up our efforts and harness the full potential of trade and industrialization to advance sustainable, inclusive growth. The African Continental Free Trade Area is set to be an engine of that growth. Its full implementation could generate income gains of up to 9% by 2035, according to latest estimates. And this would lift up to 50 million people out of extreme poverty and reduce income inequalities.
With the theme accelerating the implementation of the African Continental Free Trade Area, the AU is calling on member states to review their success, challenges, milestones, and plan a way forward to greater political and economic prosperity. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Moreno Jiambo in Sacramento, California.
There were no violations on Thursday of Sudan's short-term ceasefire, which took effect on Tuesday this week. The United Nations says the fighting between the Sudan military and the rapid support forces has forced more than 1.3 million people to flee the country. Mohamed Al-Tahishi is a former member of Sudan's Transitional Sovereign Council. From Khartoum, he tells me that the ceasefire violations were reported not only in Khartoum, but in the town of Al-Fasheh in the western region of Darfur.
A conflict widely been spread over the country since this morning. It is the third day of the truce, widely reported from Al-Fashir and also reported from Zelinje, Darfur. And I can confirm here from Khartoum, where I'm living, many parts of this capital trigger a conflict since this morning. Been used on all these conflicts, airstrike, I can hear dust everywhere, and heavily gun. So yes, the conflict been renewed today, despite the ceasefire agreement, despite the continuation of suffering of the people.
When you and I spoke earlier this week about the beginning of the ceasefire, you were optimistic that things were moving in the right direction. What happened?
Yes, when this agreement been signed, not only me optimistic, I can see all the people are very happy because this two party given them some hopes. So I was optimistic because of the good reason. Number one, the parties offered their commitment to implement this agreement as it is. And international community put its heavy weight behind this agreement and put a pressure, actual pressure, on the parties to get this agreement implemented. So yes, and I still see there is a good reason for this two party to allow the people to get their life continued. That's never been a case, sadly. And never been a case, I think, and I believe, because of one of this party made a huge U-turn and shows how it's not ready for an agreement. And this is very concerning.
Who is responsible for the renewed fighting? Is it both sides? Is this the Sudanese army or the rapid response forces?
Certainly, that is a good question. I think there is a problem, and I can also say that is a crisis inside the Sudanese army. A major division is going on that organization, and I think it's a very complicated division. The Islamists exist, the Egyptian exist, some commands exist, and that's made all this chaos. I don't believe that Burhan has overall control over this organization. So consequences of this chaos, I think they cannot give any assurance that they are going to implement any agreement they did part of it.
Mohamed Al-Tahishi is the former Sovereign Council member and a senior peace fellow at Washington, D.C.-based Public International Law and Policy Group. He was speaking with us from Khartoum, Sudan. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, has asked the Malawi government to stop forceful relocation of about 8,000 refugees who are staying outside the country's only refugee camp. The agency says the camp is severely overcrowded. The government says the refugees living outside the camp are breaking the law. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
The relocations, which began last week, follow an April 15 deadline. The Malawian government set for the refugees to voluntarily relocate to the Dzalika camp in accordance with a policy that requires them to live on the camp grounds. However, the UNHCR says the exercise is causing a lot of suffering for the refugees. Olga Sarado is a spokesperson for the UNHCR in Geneva. She told VOA via a messaging app that the agency is concerned with how the policy is being enforced.
As some refugees tell us, that they had to quickly leave their homes, leave everything behind. And some families got separated as they had to run in different directions, fearing to be arrested or detained.
Police say over 500 refugees have been forcibly relocated to the camp so far in an operation that started last week. The UNHCR Salado says conditions at the Dzaleka camp, which now houses over 50,000 refugees, four times the camp's capacity, are unbearable.
This means that the services available, they cannot cope with new arrivals at the moment. There are plans for expansions. There are plans to find alternative settlements. But at the moment, nothing is of this is in place. And also, due to funding shortfalls, UNHCR cannot provide additional support to what is being provided at the moment in the camp.
Many refugees who have so far returned from Dzaleka have told VOA that they are sleeping in an open with no food and clothes. Rafael Ndabaga is a refugee from the Democratic Republic of Congo. He told VOA Thursday that the police detained him and seven others at an ad hoc roadblock near the camp, despite getting permission from camp officials to travel and buy food and other commodities.
We are all asked to return back to the camp in their own van. They said a refugee is not allowed to leave the camp, whatever the reason. Whether you have a permit, this is a mess, because if we are locked, which means whatever is not found locally, we cannot get it. So people will die of hunger. There will not be difference between being a refugee and being a prisoner.
The UNHCR says the government should stop the forceful relocations, register all the refugees staying outside the camp, and assist their needs. That way, it says children can go to school, people with illnesses can get medical treatment, and refugees can find adequate shelter. A spokesperson for the Minister of Homeland Security did not retain calls from VOA seeking comment. However, Homeland Security Minister Kenis Kalingoma said Friday that the government would not reverse its decision on relocations, saying doing so would mean condoning lawlessness. Malawi's parliament leaders have said the relocation exercise is in line with Malawi's legislation on refugees and that the government is not breaking any international law. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta, Malawi.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Friday, May 26. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. As Zimbabwe prepares for general elections, journalists are hoping to avoid a repeat of the harassment and attacks they faced while trying to cover past elections. Borrowing a strategy successfully tried in Lesotho, Zimbabwean journalists met with top officials of the ruling ZANU-PF party this week to reach mutual understanding before campaigning starts. The journalists are also scheduled to meet with the opposition and government entities like the army and police. Columbus Mavunga has more from Zimbabwe's capital, Harare.
Those are Zimbabwean journalists from both private and publicly owned companies making jokes with the ZANU-PF officials at the offices of the country's ruling party. Years back, or even weeks ago, that would be unheard of. Just entering the premises, especially for private and foreign media journalists, was unusual and highly difficult. Leopold Kudakwashe Munhende from privately owned newzimbabwe.com is one of the journalists who earlier this year was chased away from a ZANU-PF event.
It was important to highlight the challenges and fears we have as journalists going into the election. That way, probably we can find solutions together with the political parties. The most important thing about these kind of meetings is that they ensure the safety and professional handling of journalists. also political parties get a platform to air out their grievances with what we are doing as journalists, and we can find amicable solutions.
Victoria Ruzidzo, editor of the government-controlled weekly newspaper, The Sunday Mail, attended the meeting as well.
I think this meeting was very important because what we need is facts and factual information, and we can only get that through open lines of communication. So it gives us a platform to air our concerns as the media and for ZANU-PF to also tell us where we think we're going wrong. If you notice, there were a lot of perceptions and misconceptions about a lot of things, but if you sit down at such platforms, you get to understand each other and you build a stronger relationship, which is better for the media, in that when we need certain information, like what the SG said, we have access to him any minute, we can get information.
Columbus Mafungam for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
The world is paying tribute to the late queen of rock and roll, Tina Turner, who passed away this week at age 83. Joining us to talk about the legacy of Tina Turner is Heather Maxwell, producer and host of VOA Music Time in Africa. Good morning to you, Heather, and welcome to Daybreak Africa.
Thank you, James. Good morning.
Thank you very much for joining us. The world has been reacting to the news of the passing of Tina Turner, the lady they call the queen of rock and roll. What can you tell us?
Oh, you know, I can tell you that everybody is touched and saddened deeply by her passing, even though she died at age 83 and had led a wonderfully successful life, despite the difficult beginning she had. But, you know, she's really one of a kind, and people loved her not only for her music and her great legs, she was known for that, and her voice, but also, maybe even more so, her spirit. She was such a powerful woman, optimistic, never stopped, never quit, and went through hard times. And she's just been an inspiration and a model for especially women, and women across the board, white, black, Hispanic, young, old, you know, to keep trying to do what you want to do despite oppression or, you know, difficulties in your life. So it's sad for us, but also, you know, Tina Turner and her legacy will never, ever die. And it will always, I think it will always be an inspiration for women.
That's great. And Heather, you mentioned that she was a voice for other women, and they talk about her being the champion for abused women.
Well, when she was a young girl, she married Ike Turner, who was also a musician, and he was the leader of their duo. They became quite famous for that, and they were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame way back then. But he turned abusive once they were married, to the extent that they even made a film about her, a movie that's quite good about Tina Turner that depicts all of that. And I saw an interview with her recently, and she said, you know, somebody asked her, what do you think about that movie? And Tina Turner said, I liked the movie, but, you know, it could have been more. She said, you know, it wasn't all the way true, but I don't think people could have handled the real truth of it. And if you've seen that movie, James, or whoever is listening has seen that movie, it's very difficult to watch. But she's saying that even that was watered down compared to the abuse that Ike delved out to her.
Heather, thank you so much for joining us on Daybreak Africa.
Thank you so much for having me, James.
That was Heather Maxwell, producer and host of VOA Music Time in Africa. The program airs Saturday and Sunday. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport in Argentina, where the Nigeria under-20 national team, the Flying Eagles, may face Uruguay, Ecuador or Honduras in the round of 16 of the ongoing FIFA under-20 World Cup in Argentina. The Flying Eagles won their first two Group D games against Dominican Republic and Italy to seal their round of 16 ticket, but must avoid losing to Brazil in their last group game so as not to finish third if Italy beat Dominican Republic. A draw or or a win this weekend will win the group for the Flying Eagles, while a loss to the young Samba Stars will see them finish as runners-up. And now to Ghana, where former Ghana international Anthony Bafor has urged football agents to place importance on the development of young footballers than prioritizing money. Speaking at the launch of the Baby Jet on the 16th African Football Tournament, Bafor suggested that education of young talented players is very important in developing the next generation of football stars from Africa.
The educational part is very, very important. And for me, it's a scholarship for players. It's like you go into a university and you get a scholarship. That is it, that's it. There are also football schools where you pay to learn how to play football. Like I said, it's not written on your forehead that you're going to be a professional footballer. But, you know, if it's not happening immediately, it could be in a couple of years later. And that's why you should always pursue your education.
And now to rugby, where South African national rugby team captain Siya Kolisi is on track with his rehabilitation from knee ligament surgery and could be given until the start of the Rugby World Cup itself to be ready to lead his team on the Global Showpiece event in France. Springbok coach Jack Niemba and South Africa Rugby Union director of rugby Rassie Erasmus told a press conference in Cape Town, South Africa on Thursday that standing captains will be appointed to lead a team in the rugby championships that will be played as a prelude to the World Cup. The South African national rugby team will play the All Blacks in a warm-up game in London 2 weeks before the kickoff of the World Cup. And now to Kenya, where Kenya has signed a partnership with Cuba that will see Kenya's Olympic athletes travel to Havana for pre-games training camps in boxing, volleyball, and athletics. Kenya Sports Cabinet Secretary Ababu Nawamba said the need to step up the fight against doping menace in Kenya is the motivation behind this partnership.
We want to make sure that our preparations on our very big agenda of clean sports, competing and winning clean, zero tolerance to doping, that message is crystal clear to everybody in this ecosystem.
And that's it for this Friday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a nice weekend. And that is it for this Friday, May 26th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I am James Barton in Washington, wishing that you will have a great weekend. We'll see you again on Monday morning.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and our panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including the latest on negotiations between President Joe Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy on raising the U.S. government's $31.4 trillion debt ceiling with days before a possible default. For this and more, join us for Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
We are bringing women voices to the conversation on things that matter to the hearts and minds of women. From right here in the nation's capital to on the ground from all over the African continent. We hear your voices, our voices. Right here on VOA on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC.
Every Wednesday and Friday at 9 p.m. UTC time with your pilot, Roger Moon, to listen to the RM Show, where you can respond to our question of the week, get some entertainment news, and enjoy some great music. It's all happening at VOA Africa. God bless. Peace, Africa.